Lucia Moholy's photographs have always been really important to my research in looking at the Bauhaus, the history of the Bauhaus, because her photographs really capture the buildings, the objects, the people in that time period. So I've always been really interested in what her photographs look like, but also what they explain to us, what they hand down to us as historical artifacts. I'm Robin Childenfry, art and architectural historian at the Courtauld, University of London. I've done a lot of research on Lucia Moholy's photographs, particularly her time at the Bauhaus.
My name is Anja Guttenberger, and this is my podcast, Bauhaus Faces. Welcome to a new episode of Bauhaus Faces. I am Anja, your host. Today's episode of Bauhaus Faces is about a photographer that most Bauhaus fans today know, Lucia Moholy. She was the photographer who delivered the photos of the Bauhaus in Dessau and its master's houses that made the art school so iconic. But it wasn't until the 1990s that art historians became alert to her when her photos and negatives made their way into the Bauhaus archive in Berlin. But until then, they had taken a long reroute from Germany via the US, while Lucia Moholy had thought they were lost, when in fact Bauhaus founder and first director Walter Gropius had taken them with him, denied their possession for decades and made use of them to promote the Bauhaus as the ultimate epitome of the avant-garde, without ever mentioning their creator, Lucia Moholy. But her life and work was so much more. When she was in danger of being arrested by the Nazis, Lucia fled Germany and emigrated to London. Here, she worked as a portrait photographer and, as director, set up the microfilm archive ASLIP. She never succeeded in emigrating to the US like so many other Bauhauslers, although she had an offer from her ex-husband, Laszlo Moholy Nagy, to come and teach photography at the new Bauhaus in Chicago. Most of her adult life, Lucia Moholy struggled to make ends meet and gain recognition for her achievements. When she, once more, emigrated to Switzerland in 1959, she would live and die in Zollikon near Zurich, Lucia started writing about her collaborative work with Laszlo Moholy Nagy and her own share in it. If you have already listened to the Bauhaus Faces episodes about Tilux Feininger, Otto Berger and Isa Gropius, I'm sure you will find some parallels to Lucia Moholy's life too. For this episode, I asked the US art historian Robin Schuldenfrei to help me tell the story of Lucia Moholy. She researched many aspects of Moholy's work, among others the story of Lucia's lost glass negatives, and has published her insights in several books and articles. So, let's dive into a new episode of Bauhaus Faces and shine a light on Lucia Moholy.
Lucia Moholy was born as Lucy Schultz in January of 1894. She later changes her first name to Lucia. She was an excellent student growing up, and she always kept a journal and also went on to secondary school and also gained her teaching credentials in the English language. And so she was always a remarkable linguist as well. She moves to Germany around 1915, and she works for a number of newspapers in the period and in publishing generally. She edits. She also does some of her own writing. She meets Laszlo Moholy Nagy, a really up-and-coming but very young and not well-known artist in that period, and she marries him in 1921. So Laszlo Moholy Nagy has a double-barreled last name, but Lucia just takes the Moholy. So she's then officially changes her name to Lucia Moholy. When Laszlo Moholy Nagy is called to the Bauhaus and given an important professorship there, she moves with him. The Bauhaus in this period is in Weimar, and so they join the Weimar iteration in 1923. And she really begins her apprenticeship and her work with photography in this period. She apprentices herself to Hermann Eckner, who is in Weimar, and she also takes a course in Leipzig. And she really quickly acquires the skills she needs to take photographs, to develop them in this period. She moves with Laszlo and the entire Bauhaus in 1926, when the entire school moves to Dessau and eventually is able to live in one of the houses that Gropius builds for the faculty. Lucia, I think, was well-liked at the Bauhaus. I think she had good friends. I think there very much was a division between the Bauhaus masters and then the people who were helpful to the masters, but were the wives. I think she did spend time with Issei and Walter Gropius. Certainly, she's included in some of the sort of fun party pictures that you see at the Bauhaus. But I think that she was a really serious person. She didn't, you know, play in the jazz band or that kind of thing. You see her also at in pictures of the Dada meetups of the period as well. So I think she was very involved artistically, intellectually, and socially. But I think she also worked very hard and took a really serious role within the context of the Bauhaus. I think she was very good friends with some of the other women. We have really nice portraits that she took of them, but it's a little hard to tell how close she was as a friend to them versus to what degree she was just honing her skills and providing portraits that artists need when they have exhibitions. And so I do think she was well-liked and well-regarded within the Bauhaus. Eventually, Laszlo and Moholy leave Dessau in 1928, and they also separate, although the divorce isn't finalized till a bit later, in 1929. In Berlin, she's really busy working at the Itten School and also working still with her ex-husband, Laszlo Molinage, on various opera documentation and teaching. She's traveling. She also takes up and has a new partner, Theodor Neubauer. Theodor Neubauer is married in the period, so this is an extra relationship on his part. And he's also the communist parliamentary member and an activist in the period. And so in the 1930s, as the Nazis really come to power, he becomes a political opponent of the regime. He is actually in Lucia Moholy's apartment when it is raided by the Nazis, and he's arrested on the 3rd of August, 1933. And at that point, Lucia flees to Prague. When Lucia Moholy's apartment was raided by the Gestapo, she, in a prearranged plan with Theodor Neubauer, fled that evening. She took a suitcase and she was forced to leave behind 500 to 600 glass negatives. She had taken these Bauhaus era photographs using a large format wooden camera mounted on a tripod. So it was not at all these small handheld cameras that were just coming into fashion and that Laszlo Moholy-Nagy himself used, but rather a very cumbersome apparatus. And the photographs, once again, were sort of an A4 sheet of paper. She took them at 13 by 18 centimeters or 18 by 24 centimeters. So these glass plates were very cumbersome in crates and not something you could flee overnight from the Nazis with. She ends up going to Prague and Paris and eventually ends up just with a suitcase in London. When she gets to London, she's really concerned with housing herself, and she does get a lot of help from Quakers and other sympathetic people in London to help her get set up, but she was mainly concerned trying to get Theodor Neubauer out of prison. And so she does a lot of activism. Important people write letters on his behalf. And in fact, he is first in a Brandenburg prison, then at Esterwegen, which is a prisoner for political opponents. And he had to do hard labor in the peat bogs. He was released in 1939, but then he was arrested again in 1944 and executed in February of 1945 in Zuchthaus Brandenburg. But in that period, she was in London without her negatives and really focused on getting him out of prison. It transpires that she asked Laszlo Moholy-Nagy to collect up the negatives and put them in his basement, which he does do. He eventually then comes over to England, as does Walter Gropius, and she never loses touch with Laszlo Moholy-Nagy, his wife Sibel, or Walter or E.C. Gropius during that time. There are ample letters all the way through the whole period. Eventually, Walter Gropius gets the call to go to Harvard to become the chair of the architecture department. So he leaves and moves to Massachusetts, where he eventually builds a house in Lincoln, Massachusetts, and takes up his position at Harvard. Laszlo Moholy-Nagy leaves next, and he is offered the position of the director of the new Bauhaus in Chicago, which eventually becomes the School of Design in Chicago. Lucia Moholy tried desperately to emigrate to the U.S. She was really trying to get a librarian position or teaching the photography or history of photography, but also photographic techniques in the U.S. Gropius was trying to help her get a position at MIT. Laszlo invited her to become the photo teacher at the new Bauhaus in Chicago. And it was really, the emigration laws were really strong in that period. And it was much easier for the men who were coming to take leadership positions to get the visas necessary to come over. Lucia Moholy's brother also was a successful playwright and screenwriter in Hollywood, and he also attempted to sponsor her. So all of this documentation and all of her attempts during the period from 1940 onwards, when World War II was in full force and London was really under severe bombardment, she was really trying to get to the U.S. and every door was shut to her. And so that was really a problem. Laszlo and Sibel continue to try to help her all the way through. As part of the Bauhaus circle, lots of care packages were sent to those who remained in Europe, whether in Germany or elsewhere. From the Bauhaus group, they made a kind of Bauhaus circle, which would support the people who couldn't get out over to the U.S. or get out to safety. And Sibel even sort of commiserates in a letter to Lucia, "The reports from England are very depressing, and I would be happy to send you whatever you need to supplement your obviously meager diet. Please, Lucia, don't hesitate to let me know what you need." And so it was very clear for those fortunate enough to be in the safety and employment and have housing in the U.S. that they were, in fact, really fortunate, and Lucia really was in dire straits. She tries to make a living by taking photographs there. She takes especially portrait photography and captures really kind of sitters. And she takes very important photographs of prominent sitters and now in the National Portrait Gallery's collection, permanent collection. So barons, lords, academics, literary figures, writers, publishers, editors, politicians. She doesn't become wealthy. It's a period of struggle for her during the entire time that she lives in London. However, she is able to do that.
I was really curious about which photos Robin liked best from the portraits by Lucia Moholy, so I asked her to choose one of the Bauhaus face and one of the London face. So she did.
I really like the photo Lucia took of Annie Albers in 1927. She also took a photo of Joseph Albers at the same time. And this picture of Annie Albers shows her in profile against a white wall, but with beautiful light coming in. The face is very clear. You get the sensitivity and introspection of Annie Albers in this 1927 image. She's sitting there in perfect 1927 dress, very much of the period, but also has a kind of somber quality. You understand what a serious weaver and artist that Annie Albers is. In London, it's very interesting to compare that photograph to one she took of the Countess of Oxford and Asquith in 1937. And this is an older lady who's wearing a kind of fetching, looks like a batik scarf. And she's also in profile, but she's sort of blurred the face a little bit. So you get a good sense of the quite distinctive nose. The prominence of the sitter is clear. You can see her hair swept up into a bun, but it's graying. And here you can also see the ravages of time. She's not made up, but rather you can see that she does have wrinkles, but it's a very beautiful portrait where you have, again, really the sense this is a thoughtful person. This is an intelligent sitter. You get a sense of the character of the person. But here, instead of having a kind of sharpness and a crispness, she really carefully manipulates the focus of the camera's lens to capture really evocatively the sort of sense of age, the sense of time of this sitter. I think Lucia Moholy's portrait photographs are really thoughtful, both on the part of how Lucia is depicting the person, whether it's a prominent countess or it's a creative artist. I think she really takes the time to create an image that will reflect the nature of the sitter, him or herself. And I think the reception of these images are also important, which is why her photos are in the National Portrait Gallery in London and elsewhere, because they really are important documents and look very different than kind of standard portrait photography of the period, which the sitters themselves remark upon. The Countess of Oxford did in fact write her and say, you know, I'm really pleased with how this photo came out. Essentially, it's much nicer than a kind of standard sort of beauty shot that a normal photographer might have taken of me. It really captures her essence. And I think the sitters really understood this.
Maybe you already know that I too was mesmerized by Lucia Moholy's work. For me, it was always her self-portraits that spoke to me. In my PhD thesis about photographic self-portraits at the Bauhaus that is published on the website of the Freie Universität Berlin, I dedicated a whole chapter to Lucia and her self-portraits. The only designated self-portrait of Lucia Moholy is dated 1930. She had left the Bauhaus with Laszlo Moholy Nagy in 1928, and they again moved to Berlin. Here, Lucia became a theater and exhibition photographer, worked for the photo agency Mauritius, and eventually led the photography department at the Ittenschule as a successor to the famous photographer Umbo. The end of her marriage to Laszlo Moholy Nagy in 1929 marked her artistic and personal independence. To my mind, her self-portrait from 1930 highlights this new phase of her life. The photograph depicts her in a thoughtful pose, her hands supporting her chin with a symmetrical composition, emphasizing her face and hands. Unlike her typical objective and technical portraits of others, this self-portrait is more introspective, highlighting psychological depth through details like the visible texture of her skin and shadows under her eyes. Though meticulous about documenting her work, Lucia Moholy did not include this self-portrait in her records, suggesting that she considered it a personal project rather than a public one. In contrast to her architecture and product photography, this portrait emphasizes her natural appearance and emotional introspection. At least that's what I think. In the Lucia Moholy estate at the Bauhaus Archive in Berlin, there are more portraits of her that may or may not be self-portraits. The first series from around 1930 to 31 features five photos where Moholy, dressed in a white blouse and dark vest, explores different facial expressions and body postures. The second series, likely taken a couple of years later, shows an older Moholy outdoors, with natural light highlighting her facial features and clear signs of aging. In some photos she looks curiously into the camera, maybe wondering what the photo will look like. Lucia Moholy emphasizes a raw, unretouched depiction of herself. She includes two distinct character traits in each photographic series, the cheerful and the serious intellectual woman. Thus, she presents herself as a woman with two faces, the private and the public Lucia Moholy. Her self-portrait series are unique within the Bauhaus and once more mark her very own portrait photography style. Just like in the photos of the Bauhaus buildings and products, her portrait photography was precise. Her architecture and product photos were different from the popular photos of the new vision and the new objectivity. Her approach was to isolate the objects or building from their context and to avoid extreme angles and shadows. That way, she let the object speak for itself. Lucia Moholy applied a similar precision to her portrait photography. In her depiction of Bauhaus people like Annie Albers or Lou Schaper, or of Bauhaus-related artists like the Die Steyr couple Theo and Nelly van Doesburg, or the French photographer Florence Henri, she chose very strict profile photos in which their geometrical haircuts and sharp physiognomic features predominate the focus. Some of these photos are complemented by a second portrait from the front. Her portrait photos from the 1930s in London, though, differ from those portraits of the Bauhaus. Of every person, she took at least a series of 2 to 3 photos, if not more. Always from a different side, as if she tried to find an all-embracing portrait or to create a triptych with a photo from the left, one from the right, and one from the front. She would sometimes add photos of the portrait person with their gaze looking down. She started that kind of serial portrait photography in Berlin in 1929. A series of portraits of the socialist Clara Zetkin consists of 6 photos, starting with a profile photo and then moving on to the front in the subsequent images, ending in a portrait of Clara Zetkin's hands in her lap. When you click through the photos rapidly, it seems like a short film, trying to capture the essence of the politician in her early 70s, who was the initiator of the International Women's Day. Lucia Moholy's self-portrait from 1930 seems to be somewhat in between these two creative phases, between Bauhaus and London. And of course, 1930, that makes sense because she was in Berlin, in between the Bauhaus and London. Her self-portrait series, however, stylistically belonged to her London portraits. One last comparison of her designated self-portrait before I stop talking about portraits, I promise. It's that of Walter Gropius that Lucia Moholy made in 1927. The portrait was shot from the front. Walter Gropius' hands support his tensed face. He is frowning, his shoulders are pulled up a little, and his eyes are fixating the camera. The background is blurred and unidentifiable. Parts of his upper body with jacket and tie are visible. His hair is neatly combed. The whole composition of this portrait of the Bauhaus founder resembles that of Lucia Moholy's designated self-portrait from 1930. The only difference is the position of her hands. While Gropius spreads out the index and the middle fingers on each side of his face, Moholy keeps her hands folded to support her chin. And even today, after so many years, I still ask myself if this self-portrait was special for Lucia Moholy too. Let's return to Robin. She's now talking about the architectural photos of the Bauhaus buildings that Lucia Moholy took when she lived there. One or the other photo of the Bauhaus or the master's houses have probably already crossed your way in the many publications and films about the Bauhaus. They are objective yet highlight the modern features of the buildings, such as the huge glass facades and the geometrical reduced balconies with clean steel balustrades and the modular building system of the master's houses. These images that Lucia Moholy took in 1926 of the Bauhaus buildings in Dessau made it possible for Walter Gropius to promote his art school as iconic from a distance in the US. But at what cost?
The question is whether Lucia was paid, to what extent she was commissioned for these by now iconic and really remarkable series of Bauhaus photos, its output, the other people in the Bauhaus community. There is absolutely no record in the immense archive and incredible record keeping of the Bauhaus that she was in any way commissioned or paid for her work. She herself writes that she entirely freely gave of her time and was, I think, pretty happy to do it. What she did do, though, was when she printed out her images from her large format glass plate negatives, which are essentially the size of an A4 piece of paper. So these are very large negatives. She always kept the negatives. And when she made copies, she did not charge to school members or when they were published in the Bauhaus publications or else elsewhere in other journals where you can find them in the period. So any kind of publicity for the Bauhaus, she absolutely freely gave not only the original images themselves as reproducible print copies, but she did always keep her photo credit. It will say photo Lucia Moholy, and she always stamped on the verso reproduction forbidden Lucia Moholy. So she would put her stamp so you knew who to credit the photo, and also that reproduction without proper credit or without acknowledging permission from her was forbidden. But she absolutely did share them. She would sometimes collect very small fees when people wanted to use them for sort of other purposes. But again, what she doesn't have is her Bauhaus negatives. And she's asked to give a lecture about the history of the Bauhaus. And she wants to do that, but she doesn't have anything. And so she actually writes Gropius this last-minute letter in 1950, looking for just any generic Bauhaus photographs, whether Gropius could send Lucia some photographs so she could illustrate her lecture that she was giving at the London School of Printing and Graphic Arts. And he says that he has very few, and what he does have, he can't let out of his hands. And she apologizes for bothering him. And she really is forced to bypass crucial opportunities because she thinks her negatives are gone. She writes Laszlo and Sibel to ask where they left her negatives. And they tell her that they brought them to Gropius's basement and that Gropius's basement was firebombed. And this is true. His basement was firebombed during World War II and the building completely destroyed. It was in the Tiergarten. And so she thinks her negatives are destroyed and was just hoping to find some, you know, copy images from the period. When the war ends and publications and mail starts to flow a lot more regularly, she starts to see a series of publications with really high quality reproductions of her negatives. And it's clear from her very well-trained eye that these are not copies of photographs, but perhaps real originals were used to make these images. And so she begins to think that maybe her negatives did survive and somebody else has them. So she starts to ask around. She continues to ask around. Finally, in 1954, because she is writing and preparing a lecture on the topic of Bauhaus team spirit, she writes Gropius again to see if he had any idea, if he knew where they could possibly be, whether he could remember anything, kind of whether there was a trail that she could follow. And Gropius replies to this letter for the first time in 17 years after bringing the negatives with him to the U.S., that actually he is in fact in possession of them. He writes, "Long ago in Berlin, you gave all these negatives to me. I have carefully kept them, had copies made of all of them, and have given a full set of copies to the Buschreisinger Museum at Harvard," that's the German museum there, "which has built up a special Bauhaus department, which is steadily growing. I have promised them the original negatives with your name attached as soon as I do not need them anymore myself." Gropius also writes, "You will imagine these photographs are extremely useful to me and that I have continuously made use of them. I hope you will not deprive me of them. Wouldn't it be sufficient if I sent you contact prints of the negatives? There are a great many, but I certainly understand that you might want to make use of them yourself. Anyhow, it will be a relief to you to know they are in existence and in good shape. I've never left them out of hand." So that is when she makes this horrific discovery that, in fact, well, it's good that the negatives are not destroyed as she thought, but that Gropius has them. She, in fact, then at this point needs to engage a lawyer, and it takes her several more years to get to the point in which Gropius actually ships back her negatives. Of course, Gropius could have apologized profusely and shipped on the next boat going back the crates of images. He could have made good immediately on the absconding of her negatives. At least he did keep them safe, which is a point he made, although her lawyer then makes the point that when a fireman saves articles from a burning house, does he then get to keep the articles of the family's possessions, or do you give them back? And so, in fact, Gropius could have really rectified the situation immediately with an apology and a shipment. In fact, it takes the really heroic efforts of an international lawyer who really helped Moholy get them back. And she does eventually get them back. When he ships them back, he doesn't even ship them back with care. And many of them are actually broken in transit in the return. And in fact, there's also many images that she discovers aren't even hers in the shipment. So it's not as if he went carefully back through and knew which images were hers and not. Her images were very widely published. I think he would have, had he taken care or consulted, in fact, her or her card catalog, could have shipped back just her glass plate negatives. And so it's a really unfortunate incident in the history of photography. I think that he really saw these important images of his building as part of the documentation of his building, in one sense. She did make them really willingly for, in a sense, him in the period, but she had always retained the negatives. So part of it is a sense of the architecture also being the images of the architecture. And that's an argument I make in my writing about this episode, that in fact, we understand his architecture better precisely through her remarkable images. She didn't change her position in terms of getting credit for her images. Right from the early 20s, as soon as she started making images, she insisted on having a photo credit. It always said in small writing, "Photo Lucia Moholy." So long as a publication gave photo credits, she included hers there. Where you don't see the photo credits is during the period in which Walter Gropius was giving away her images and giving away the copyright to them. And you see that in letters where he will say to somebody who wants to publish a picture, "Oh, I have the copyright, so you know, just feel free to publish them as much as you like," essentially, in so many words. I don't think Lucia ever changed her position in terms of getting credit. We have a huge power imbalance here. She is penniless and alone in London. She writes of her extreme poverty in these years. He is the chair of the Department of Architecture at Harvard and a really important figure in the period. And so I think we also have a power imbalance and, of course, in the period, a gender imbalance. I think it's important when looking at gender imbalance to understand the cultural context of the period. And that's something that I always do in my research, is I really try to use the context of the period, the images of the period, the writing of the period, and the documents of the period, as well as sometimes even the fiction of the period, to really get a good sense of how art came into being and buildings and other media came into being in the period. And I think that with the case of Lucia, she was very talented, very serious about her work, and a very collaborative person. She was someone who was editing. She was active politically. She worked very collaboratively on images and editing of items coming out of the Bauhaus with her husband, even when he was her ex-husband. Lucia and Laszlo had a really close, collaborative, and very important creative relationship and intellectual relationship. When they were together as husband and wife, they actively collaborated on many aspects of photography, experiments such as the photograms. Laszlo was very much dependent on her darkroom skills, and much of his output was very much helped by her, even though he is singly credited for the photograms themselves. She also was an incredible linguist, absolutely fluent in English and German, and that became important for editing the Bauhaus books. Laszlo Moholy-Nagy was an incredible thinker, an incredible theorist, but his German skills were always just developing in this period. And so it was really important that in a certain way that Lucia was able to translate, as it were, or smooth out Laszlo's German in his publications. And so they had a really important, really positive working relationship. Even when they separated, they remained absolutely in contact. They relied upon each other. She certainly took photographs of Laszlo's subsequent works so that he would have a way of documenting them. And so it was a really important collaboration, both the intensity of it during their relationship, especially in holidays that they took together to alternative communities where he first learned about the photogram methods up in the hills. Lucia Moholy did a tremendous amount of editing work and help on especially the Bauhaus book series. When her photographs were used in those Bauhaus book series, for instance, there's a volume on the buildings of the Bauhaus by Walter Gropius, her photographs are credited when they were used. And her photographs were always credited during the period in which she had her negatives and contributed to publications. She was not credited for her work with the photograms with Laszlo, even though he talks of their collaborative, generative early experience with them. The very important text, Production, Reproduction, is also singly credited to him. And the short sort of theoretical text on the stakes of reproduction and photography and modernism, modern reproductive technologies more generally, was also not directly credited. In terms of Lucia's editing capacity and her help in the Bauhaus books and elsewhere, she absolutely wasn't credited for that kind of behind the scenes, especially linguistic smoothing over of the German. I think that was just part of the relationship with a period that those who had better linguistic abilities helped others. With Issei and Walter Gropius spoke no English practically when he arrived in England, but Issei Gropius was absolutely nearly fluent and did all of their correspondence. And so that was really the norm in the period. And so I think with the gender imbalance, we also have to take into consideration the collaborative nature and the generosity, the intellectual and creative generosity of Lucia Moholy. I think that's important as well. One would hope that the same thing wouldn't happen in today's day and age, and it absolutely doesn't excuse it. But I do think that there was a difference in the way women were viewed and the way in which they were credited. And to a certain extent, I think that the women of the Bauhaus were really happy to be part of this collaborative spirit and this really interesting project that was the Bauhaus in the period. And you see that in the work of other women as well. I don't know that they always needed to be credited because in fact, much was just published sort of or brought out into the world under the Bauhaus name. Yes, I think we can really understand that gender imbalances have come a long way from the 1920s Bauhaus era to the post-war period and then the 60s and 70s and up to today. And I think Lucia Moholy is finally really getting her due with the important exhibition exposures at Kunsthal Praha, which is open right now in 2024 and will also travel. But also in 1972, she publishes her second book called Moholy-Nagy, Marginal Notes, Documentary Absurdities. And there she tries to set the record straight, both in her own role and also correct many factual errors about Laszlo Moholy-Nagy. And she doesn't do that to bring herself up or overinflate her role. But actually, again, I think she was a very rational, a very truthful, a very straightforward person. And just to correct the record, I think that was always important to her.
When we are talking about her second book, of course, we have to talk about her first book as well. That was 100 Years of Photography, published in 1939. In its preface, Lucia Moholy wrote, "This little book does not claim by any means to be a complete history of photography. It has been written not to replace any of those previously published, but because it was felt that at the age of 100, which by now photography has reached, it may be worthwhile to give a thought not only to the achievements of photography as such, but to the part it has played by mutual give and take throughout these 100 years in the life of man and society." With this, Lucia Moholy clearly puts the relationship and developments of photography and society intertwined with each other into the foreground. Although it is not her focus, she also talks about the technique of photography because, as she put it, quote, "every art has its technique, so has photography." She skillfully interweaves the history of photography with societal developments such as the industrialization and wars, and even dedicates her attention to amateur photography because, quote, "every period had its amateur photographers, many of them gifted and progressive." When she gets to the 1920s, which, of course, I was most curious about, Lucia mentions the Dadaists and Surrealists and the photocollage as partakers in the development of photography, even referencing Laszlo Moholy-Nagy and Man Ray as painters who use photography, quote, "as a new medium." And then finally, she puts herself in a line with other photographers like Helmer Lersky, who in their portrait photography do not only concentrate on the shape of a face, but also on the details like skin texture, hair, nails, and dress. The portrait of the Countess of Asquith in Oxford that Robin compared to the Anne Albers portrait, both by Lucia Moholy, is depicted in the book too. It is a first step for Lucia to step into the limelight and put herself next to her male photographer colleagues rather than behind them.
100 Years of Photography is a really important book in the history of photography and its bibliography, as it were. It's a Penguin book, right when Penguin was bringing out a whole series of books that were for the mass market and very affordable, and that you could buy them in train stations and newspaper shops. And so this book was really popular and sold very, very well. And it's a really important contribution to the history of photography. She traces it through culturally. She includes some of her own work. And this is a really important book because it starts to codify and historicize photography in and of itself. 100 Years of Photography was well regarded by critics at the time. It became a sort of standard bearer in the history of photography. It was important in photo history classes or photography departments where students of photography could concentrate in that skill. And so it was a highly regarded book, and it still remains relevant today as an early charting of the history of photography, but in a very accessible way. And I think that's, again, the importance of Lucia Moholy, the clarity she brings to her subject matter, whether that's a portrait of an artist or a baron or a member of the royal family, or the clarity she brings to an image, an object of the Bauhaus, a teapot or a Bauhaus building, or to the history itself, the clarity she brings to her writing. I think that's a really important aspect of her remarkable contribution to culture more widely.
By 1942, she led the ASLIP microfilm service. ASLIP is the abbreviation for the Association of Special Libraries and Information Bureau, focusing on producing microfilm copies of German scientific journals for espionage purposes. Supported by the Rockefeller Foundation and governments, she imported advanced microfilm cameras and set up her laboratory at the Science Museum and later at the Victoria and Albert Museum. Her work in microfilm was intertwined with the global documentation movement inspired by figures like Paul Otley and Otto Neurath, aiming to democratize knowledge. Moholy viewed her work as contributing to the internationalization of science and, quote, the abolition of distance on the intellectual plane, referencing H.G. Wells' vision of a world brain.
The microfilm work that Lucia did in London is really important, in part because of the destruction of World War II and her interest in reproductive technologies of every sort. She was very involved in publishing, as we've talked about, in photography, and microfilm and the possibility of saving whole libraries because you've reproduced it and have shrunk it down into a format that could be further reproduced and also stored in a way that could keep it safe during wartime. And also she was firebombed not once but twice, so also result of fire. And of course she also thought for a long time that her negatives had been firebombed. And so this idea of reproductive technologies goes right back to the earliest conversations that she had with Laszlo Molinage, with the production reproduction essay, with the idea of the photogram, which is an object being directly imprinted on photographic paper. And I think that's important to understand Lucia's entire oeuvre as part of this interest in reproductive technologies, which of course is a very important theme of the 20th century and for art and culture alike. She moves to Switzerland, just outside of Zurich, in 1960, and she dies in 1989. So she has a good long period of which she lives there. That's where she writes her second book, Molinage Marginal Notes. She works on making new prints there, and she is part of a circle, some new friends and some old friends. She was friends with Angela Thomas, the wife of Max Bill and the new Bauhaus iteration in Ulm, where he was the director for some time. She had a good circle of former Bauhaus members who are friends, and also other just like-minded people in her kind of circle in Zurich. And she was supported by them, especially as a sort of single woman alone in old age. I think she was very much supported by her circle of colleagues and friends. She does have a measure of success. She has some solo exhibitions. She does influence a younger generation. The photographer and photo historian Ralph Saxa is a very important person who was instrumental in getting her negatives to the Bauhaus archive so that we have this historical record, not only of the negatives themselves, but also correspondence and documentation related to that. And so she's really getting the attention that she deserves now. And she did have a measure of it in her life, but it's really through the work of people researching her and her work and her importance, starting with Ralph Saxa, that becomes really important. I've written, of course, about the Bauhaus negatives in that era and that story, and then with subsequent publications by important scholars, art historians, and photo historians today. The most important archive of Lucia Moholy's work is the Bauhaus Archive in Berlin, which also has all of her documents related to the negatives and her prints. But there's also really important copies, as I mentioned throughout the interview, at the National Portrait Gallery in London. The Fotostiftung Winterthur also has many. Lucerne, the Bauhaus collection of the Busch Reisinger at the Harvard University Art Museum in Cambridge, Massachusetts, also has a few negatives and many photographic prints of her work, and also the MoMA. So she's really in important collections throughout the world, and I think that is important. And now she's just becoming much more well-known. I find many aspects of her work really interesting. First of all, the way in which she really explains the architecture of Walter Gropius, for instance, in the photographs of the Bauhaus school building and the master's houses, the nearby houses that he built for housing his faculty. I really think it's important the way she builds on and helps viewers understand the buildings through the photography itself. For instance, you can really see the way in which the Bauhaus building's glass corners tend to dematerialize, and you really get a sense of the steel and glass of their construction because she so carefully crafted her images. Another aspect I find really relevant is that she was a woman photographing in the period and was a primary documentarian in that sense of the Bauhaus and that period.
You can still visit the exhibition Lucia Moholy Exposures that Robin mentioned until 28th of October at Kunsthalle Praha. It will then move on to Fotostiftung Winterthur in Switzerland and will be opened there in February of 2025. All of the mentioned books by Lucia Moholy, the archives and museums where her photos are collected today, will be linked in the show notes. I also put some online articles in the show notes that are a really good read into Lucia Moholy's life and work. As part of the exhibition at Kunsthalle Praha, the museum recently held a symposium that they made available on their website. I will link that too, of course. One of the lecturers was Sabine Hartmann, who led the photo archive of the Bauhaus Archive in Berlin for several decades and was there when the Lucia Moholy estate arrived in 1992. She is the reason why researchers like Robin and myself got so drawn into the world of Lucia Moholy. So, go and watch this video if you want to get a better insight on how estates get into archives and museums and how the way was in this particular case. Well, as you may have noticed, Lucia Moholy and her photography still fascinate me until today. A remarkable woman who made her very own way through life and achieved so much in photography and photography history while staying true to herself. I hope you enjoyed our journey into Lucia Moholy's life and work. If you liked this episode and you like Bauhaus Faces, please leave me a 5-star rating on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you are listening to this podcast now. It helps me tremendously to become more well known. And if you know anyone who could be interested in it, please tell them to listen to it too. I would appreciate that a lot. And now there's nothing left to say but tune in to the next episode of Bauhaus Faces.